Liposuction news. Prime Minister's fat sells for $18,000. Next, celebrities to donate fat for charity. BBC News. A bar of soap made from fat liposuction from Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has been sold for $18,000 to a private collector. The soap is a work of art entitled Mani Puliti, Clean Hands, made by the artist Gianni Motti, who is based in Switzerland. Motti bought the fat from a clinic in Lugano where Berlusconi had the liposuction performed. Motti then molded it into a bar of soap, which sold at the Basel Art Fair to a private Swiss collector who can now wash his hands with Berlusconi. Commentators noted that Berlusconi is unpopular in Europe, which may have reduced the price fetched by his fat. The fat of film celebrities would be worth significantly more. The sky's the limit for Brad Pitt or Pamela Anderson byproducts, said one. Would celebrities ever sell their fat? Why not? Said a Beverly Hills plastic surgeon. It could be a charity thing. After all, they're doing the liposuction anyway. At the moment, we just throw the fat away. But they might as well use their fat to help worthy causes. Speedboat racer bums around, the butt of many jokes. Wired News Service. Wealthy New Zealander Peter Bethune will attempt to set a world record on a speedboat powered by fat from his own backside. His eco-correct 78-foot trimaran, Earth Race, is powered entirely by biodiesel fuel made from vegetable oil and other fats. In fact, Bethune's bum will make only a minor contribution to the round-the-world journey. His buttocks yielded a mere liter of fuel. However, Bethune noted that he was badly bruised and said it was a personal sacrifice to produce the fuel. Artist cooks, eats his own body fat, protests wastefulness of Western society. Reuters. New York conceptual artist Ricardo Vega underwent liposuction, cooked his fat, and ate it. He said his purpose was to draw attention to the wastefulness of Western society. He also set aside other portions of his fat for sale, noting that this would enable people to taste human flesh and experience cannibalism. Vega did not set a price for his fat, but one art dealer estimated that it would be worth considerably less than Berlusconi's. Berlusconi is a prime minister, he pointed out. Vega is an unknown. Besides, this has already been done by the artist Marcos Evarista, who made meatballs of his body fat. Marcos Evarista is a Chilean-born artist living in Denmark. Reports that his body fat meatballs would be auctioned by Christie's in New York could not be confirmed, as Christie's representatives did not return phone calls. The ambulance sped south on the freeway. Sitting in the driver's seat, wearing her new Bluetooth headset, Dolly talked to Vasco. Vasco was angry, but there was nothing Dolly could do about it. He'd set off in the wrong direction a second time. He had only himself to blame. "Look," Dolly said, "we just got telephone records for the last 5 years, just got 'em this minute. Alex calls people in this area code named Kendall, Henry, and Lynn. He's a biochemist. We don't know what she does, but Lynn and Alex are the same age. We think maybe they grew up together." "And where are they located?" Vasco said. "The Kendalls." "La Jolla? It's north of..." "I know where it is, goddammit," Vasco said. "Where are you now?" Dolly said. "Coming back from Elsinore. I'm at least an hour from La Jolla. Road's so damn twisty. God damn it, I know she was sleeping on this road somewhere."
"How do you know?"
"I just know. Got my nose working." "Okay, well, she's probably on her way to La Jolla now. She might even be there already." "And where are you?"
20 minutes from the Kendall house. You want us to pick them up?"
Vasco said. "How's the doc?"
"Sober."
"Sure."
"Close enough for government work," Dolly said. He's drinking coffee from a thermos. You check the thermos? Yes, of course. So, do we pick up or wait for you? If it's the girl, Alex, leave her alone. But if you see the kid, grab him.
Will do,
Dolly said.
Bob,
Alex said, holding her phone to her ear. She heard a groan at the other end.
What time is it?
It's 7 in the morning, Bob.
Oh, Christ.
A thump as his head hit the pillow.
This better be important, Alex.
Were you out on a wine tasting? Robert A. Koch, distinguished head of the law firm, devoted a great deal of attention to wine, kept his collection in lockers all over town, bought at auction from Christie's, made trips to Napa, Australia, France. But as far as Alex was concerned, the whole thing was just an excuse to get drunk on a regular basis.
I'm waiting, Alex, he said. It better be good.
Okay. Last 24 hours, I got a bounty hunter. Huge guy, looks like a walking brick. He's after me and my kid, trying to stick biopsy needles in us and take our cells.
Very funny. I'm waiting.
I'm serious, Bob. There's a bounty hunter chasing me and my kid.
This is out of nowhere?
No. I think it's related to Biogen.
I hear Biogen is having troubles, Bob said. And they're trying to take your cells. They probably can't do that.
Probably is not what I want to hear.
You know the law is unclear.
Look, she said, I have my 8-year-old son here. They're trying to grab him in the back of an ambulance and stick needles into his liver. I don't want to hear unclear. I want to hear we'll stop it.
We'll certainly try, he said. This is your father's case?
Yeah.
Did you call him?
He's not answering.
You call the police?
There's a warrant out for my arrest in Oxnard. There's a hearing in Oxnard today. I need somebody good to go up and appear for me.
I'll send Dennis.
I said somebody good.
Dennis is good?
Dennis is good if he has a month. This is today, Bob.
Well, who do you want?
I want you, she said.
Oh, Christ. Oxnard? It's so fucking far. I haven't had my shots.
I have a sawed-off shotgun in the back seat, Bob. I don't really care if you think the drive is too long.
Okay. Okay, take it easy, he said. I have to arrange some things.
Will you go?
Yes, I'll go. You want to give me a hint what this is about?
You'll find it in the Burnett file. I assume it has to do with takings by eminent domain or simple conversion.
Taking your cells?
They claim they own them.
How can they own your cells? They own your father's cells.
Oh, I get it. Same cells.
But that's bullshit, Alex.
Tell the judge.
They can't violate the integrity of your body or the body of your kid. Just
save it for the judge, she said. I'll call you later, find out how it went. She flipped the phone shut. She looked down at Jamie. He was still sleeping, peaceful as an angel. If Koch got to Oxnard by late morning, he might get an emergency hearing set for the afternoon. She should probably call him around 4 p.m., That seemed a very long time away. She drove toward La Jolla.
It's the last thing we need, Henry Kendall thought. Visitors! He watched in dismay as Lynn threw her arms around Alex Burnett and then bent over to hug Alex's kid, Jamie.
Alex and Jamie had just shown up, with no advance warning.
The women were chattering excitedly, arms fluttering, happy to see each other as they walked into the kitchen to get food for Alex's Jamie. Meanwhile, his son Jamie and Dave were playing Drive or Die on the PlayStation. The sound of crunching metal and squealing tires filled the room.
Henry Kendall was overwhelmed. He walked into the bedroom to think things through. He had just come back from the police station, where he reviewed the playground security camera tape from the day before. The image quality wasn't that good, thank God, because the image of that kid Billy kicking and beating his son was so upsetting he could hardly watch. He had to look away several times. And those other boys, that gang of skaters, they should all be in jail. With any luck, they'd be expelled from school. But Henry knew it wouldn't end there. It never did. Everybody sued these days, and no doubt the skater parents would sue to have their kids reinstated. They'd sue Henry's family, and they'd sue Jamie and Dave. And out of those lawsuits, it was sure to emerge that there was no such thing as Gandalf-Cricky syndrome, or whatever it was that Lynn had made up. It was sure to emerge that Dave was in reality a transgenic chimp. And then what? A media circus beyond all imagining. Reporters camped on the front lawn for weeks, chasing them wherever they went, filming them with spy cameras day and night, destroying their lives. And around the time the reporters got bored, the religious people and the environmentalists would start in. Henry and his family would be called godless. They'd be called criminals. They'd be called dangerous and un-American and a threat to the biosphere. In his mind, he saw commentators on TV in a babble of languages, English, Spanish, German, Japanese, all talking with pictures of him and Dave in the background. And that was just the beginning. Dave would be taken away. Henry could possibly go to jail, though he doubted that. Scientists had been breaking the rules about genetic testing for 2 decades, and none had ever gone to jail, even when patients died. But he would certainly be barred from research. He could be kicked out of the lab for 1 year or more. How would he support his family? Lynn couldn't do it alone, and her web business would almost certainly dry up. And what would happen to Dave, and his son, to Tracy? And what about their community? La Jolla was pretty liberal, parts of it anyway, but people might not be understanding about the idea of a humanzee going to school with their kids. It was radical, no doubt about it. People weren't ready for it. Liberals were only so liberal. They might have to move. They might have to sell their house and go somewhere remote, like Montana, though maybe people would be even less accepting of them there. These and other thoughts raced through his mind to the accompaniment of cars squealing and crashing into each other, and his wife and her friend laughing in the kitchen. He felt overwhelmed, and in the middle of it, at the center of everything, was his deep sense of guilt. One thing was clear. He had to keep track of his kids. He had to know where they were. He couldn't risk further incidents like the one that had occurred the day before. Lynn had kept the children at home for an extra hour, intending to let them go to school later so there wouldn't be any incidents with older kids. That Cleaver kid was a menace, and it wasn't likely he was jailed. They'd probably just scare him and give him over to the custody of his father. The father, Henry knew, was a defense analyst for a local think tank and a hard-ass gun nut. One of those intellectuals who liked to shoot things. A manly intellectual. There was no telling what could happen. He turned to the package he had brought home from the lab. It was marked Track Tech Industries, Chiba City, Japan. Inside were 5-inch-long polished silver tubes, slightly thinner than soda straws. He pulled them out and looked at them. These marvels of miniaturization had GPS technology built in, as well as monitors for temperature, pulse, respiration, and blood pressure. They were activated by a magnet that you touched at one end. The tip glowed blue once, then nothing. They were designed to keep track of lab primates, monkeys, and baboons.
The tubes were inserted with a special surgical instrument that looked like an oversized syringe. They were placed under the skin of the neck, just above the clavicle. Henry couldn't do that to the kids, of course. So the question was, where to put them? He went back to the living room where the kids were. Drop the sensors in their school bags? No. Down the collars of their shirts? He shook his head. They'd feel them. Then where? The surgical instrument worked perfectly. The devices went smoothly into the rubber at the heel of the sneaker. He did it for Dave's sneaker, then for Jamie's, then, on an impulse, went out and got a sneaker from Alex's son, Jamie, as well. What for? Jamie said. I need to measure it. Back in a sec. He inserted another device into the third sneaker. That left two more. Henry thought about it for a while. Several possibilities came to mind. The Hummer pulled up behind the ambulance and Vasco got out. He walked up to the ambulance. Dolly slid over onto the passenger seat. What's happening? Vasco said as he got in. Dolly nodded to the house at the end of the street. That's the Kendall place. You see Burnett's car in front. She's been in there an hour. Vasco frowned. What's going on? She shook her head. I could get the directional mic, but we have to be straight on to the windows, and I figured you didn't want me to pull up closer. Right, I don't. Vasco leaned back in his seat. He gave a long sigh. He looked at his watch. Well, we can't go in there. Bounty hunters were permitted to enter the premises of the fugitive, even without a search warrant, but they could not enter the premises of third parties, even if they knew the fugitive was there. Sooner or later, he said, they gotta come out. And when they do, we'll be here. Gerard was tired. He had been flying for an hour since his last stop, which had been something of a disaster. Shortly after dawn, he had landed at a complex of buildings where he smelled food. The buildings were made of wood with faded paint. There were old cars with grass growing up around them. Large animals made snorting sounds behind a fence. He stood on a fence post and watched a young boy in blue coveralls walking out with a bucket in his hand. Gerard smelled food. I'm hungry, he said. The young boy turned. He looked around briefly, then continued on his way. I want food, Gerard said. I am hungry. The boy paused again. He looked around again. What's the matter? Don't you know how to talk? Gerard said. Yes, the kid said. Where are you? Here. The kid squinted. He walked over to the fence. My name is Gerard.
No kidding. You can talk?
How thrilling for you, Gerard said. He could smell the bucket strongly now. He smelled corn and other grains. He could also smell something else that smelled bad, but his hunger overwhelmed him.
I want food.
What food do you want? The kid said. He reached into the bucket and scooped up a handful of feed.
You want this?
Gerard bent over, tasted it. He spit it out at once.
Yuck!
It's chicken feed. Nothing wrong with it. They eat it. Do you have any fresh vegetables? The kid laughed.
You're funny. You sound like British. What's your name?
Gerard, an orange? Do you have an orange? He hopped back and forth on the fence post, impatient.
I like an orange. How come you talk so good?
I could ask the same of you.
You know what? I'm going to show you to my dad, the kid said. He held out his hand. You're tame, aren't you? Sink me. Gerard stepped on his hand. The kid put Gerard on his shoulder. He started walking back to the wooden building. I bet we can sell you for a lot of money, he said. Gerard gave a squawk and flew up to the roof of one building. Hey, come back! From inside the house, a voice. Jared, do your chores! Gerard watched as the kid reluctantly turned back to a dirt yard, where he tossed handfuls of the grain from the bucket onto the ground. A group of yellow birds clucked and jumped as the food was thrown to them. They looked incredibly stupid. It took a moment before Gerard decided that he would eat that food after all. He flew down and made a loud squawk to drive away the stupid birds, then started eating their grain. It tasted disgusting, but he had to eat something. Meanwhile, the kid dived for him, hands outstretched. Gerard flew into the air, pecked the kid hard on the nose. The kid screamed, and then dropped down a short distance away to eat again. These big yellow birds were all around him. Get back! Get back, all of you! The yellow birds paid little attention. Gerard made the sound of a siren. The kid dived again, barely missing Gerard. He was obviously a stupid kid. Buffeting! Buffeting! 20,000 feet! Buffeting! I am going to push the stick forward! Then the sound of a huge, air-shattering explosion. The chickens scattered at that, and he had a moment of peace, eating a little. Now the kid was back with a net, and was swiping downward with it. That was too much excitement for Gerard, who was feeling sick in the stomach from the horrid food, so he flew quickly into the air, evacuating and hitting the kid perfectly on the head, before he climbed into blue sky and went on his way. 20 minutes later, in cooler air, he came to the coast and followed it. It was easier here because there were updrafts, a blessing to his tired wings. He could not soar, but it helped nonetheless. He experienced a modest sense of peace. At least he did until some giant white bird, enormously huge, gigantic, rushed silently up at him, whooshing past, creating spinning turbulence that tumbled him out of control. When Gerard got his bearings again, the bird had glided away from him on huge, flat wings. There was a single eye in the center of the head. It glinted in the sun, and the wings never moved. They just remained straight and flat. Gerard was grateful there was not a flock of these birds, but instead only one. He watched as it circled slowly toward the ground below, and that was when he noticed the beautiful green oasis in the midst of the dry coast. An oasis! It was built at the site of a large cluster of huge boulders. Surrounding the boulders were palm trees and luscious gardens and pretty buildings nestled among the green. Gerard felt certain that there would be food there. It was so inviting. He spiraled down. It was a kind of dream. Beautiful people in white robes walking silently through a garden of flowers and shrubs, in the cool shade of palm trees, with all sorts of birds flittering about. He did not smell food here, but he was sure there must be some. And then he smelled orange. Cut orange! It took him only a moment to locate another bird, brilliant blue and red, standing on a perch with lots of oranges all around him on a tray below. Oranges and avocado and bits of lettuce. Cautiously, Gerard landed next to him. I want you to want me, he said. Hello, blue and red bird said. I need you to need me. Hello. Nice place you got here. My name is Gerard. What's up, Doc? The bird said. Mind if I have an orange?
Hello, the bird said. What's up, Doc?
I said, I would like an orange.
Hello.
Gerard lost patience. He went for the orange. The blue and red bird pecked at him viciously. Gerard dodged and flapped away with the orange in his mouth. He sat on a tree branch and looked back. That was when he saw that the other bird was chained to the perch. Gerard ate the orange at his leisure. Then he flew back for more. He came at the perch from behind, then later from the side. He flew in unexpectedly, each time dodging the bird, who could only say, "Hello." After half an hour, he was quite satisfied. Meanwhile, he watched the people in white robes come and go, talking of NyQuil and Jell-O. He said, "Jell-O, the tasty dessert for the whole family, now with more Calci. Yum!" Two of the people in robes looked up. Someone laughed, then continued on their way. This place was peaceful. The water gurgled in little brooks beside the path. He would stay here, Gerard felt certain, for a long, long time.
"Okay, we got action," Vasco said.
Two young kids were coming out of the Kendall house. One was a dark kid in a baseball cap, sort of bow-legged. The other was fair, also in a baseball cap, wearing khakis and a sport shirt.
"Looks like Jamie,"
he said, putting the car in gear. They drove slowly forward.
"I don't know," Dolly said. "Doesn't look quite the same."
"It's the baseball hat. Just ask him," Vasco said.
Dolly rolled down her window. She leaned out.
"Jamie, honey."
The boy turned.
"Yes," he said.
Dolly jumped out of the car. Henry Kendall was working at the computer, activating the track tech, when he heard the high-pitched scream from outside. He knew at once that it was Dave. He bolted up and ran for the door. Behind him was Lynn, running from the kitchen. But he noticed that Alex stayed in the kitchen with her arms around her son, Jamie. She looked terrified. Dave was confused by what he saw. Jamie spoke to the woman in the big white car, and then she jumped out and grabbed him. Dave was not inclined to attack females, so he watched as the woman scooped up Jamie, took him to the back of the white car, and opened the back doors. Dave saw a man inside in a white coat, and he saw lots of shiny equipment that frightened him. Jamie must have been frightened, too, because suddenly he was screaming, and then the woman slammed the back door shut. Before the car started moving, Dave screamed and leaped onto the back, grabbing the handles on the door. The white car accelerated forward, going fast. Dave held on, struggling to keep his balance. When he had a good grip, he pulled up so he could look through the rear windows. He saw the man in the coat and the woman pushing Jamie onto a bed, trying to tie him down. Jamie was screaming. Dave felt rage flood through his body. He snarled and banged at the doors. The woman looked up in alarm. She seemed shocked to see Dave. She yelled something to the driver. The driver started to swerve the white car. Dave was flung sideways, barely able to hold on to the recessed door handles. When the car swung him back once more, he reached high, grabbing the lights above the doors. He pulled himself onto the top of the ambulance. The wind blew hard. The surface was smooth. He lay flat, inching forward. The car straightened out, drove more slowly. He heard yelling inside. He crept forward. "We lost him," Dolly yelled, looking out the back window.
"What was it?"
"Looked like an ape."
"He's not an ape. He's my friend,"
Jamie yelled, struggling.
"He goes to school with me."
The kid's baseball cap fell off, and Dolly saw that he had dark brown hair. She said, "What's your name?"
"Jamie. Jamie Kendall."
"Oh, no,"
she said.
"Oh, Christ," Vasco said, driving. "You got the wrong kid?"
He said his name was Jamie.
It's the wrong kid. Jesus Christ, you're an idiot, Dolly. This is kidnapping.
Well, it's not my fault.
Whose fault do you think it is? You saw the kid, too.
I didn't see. You were looking right out there.
Christ, shut up. Stop arguing. We gotta take him back.
What do you mean?
We gotta take him back where we found him. It's goddamn kidnapping.
And then Vasco swore and screamed. Dave was on the roof of the cab, wedged between the light bar and the slope of the ambulance. He leaned over the driver's side. There was a big side mirror there. He could see an ugly, black-bearded man driving and shouting. He knew the man was going to hurt Jamie. He could see the man baring his teeth in a sign of rage. Dave leaned down, resting his weight on the side mirror, and swung his arm in through the open window. His strong fingers grabbed the bearded man by the nose, and the man yelled and jerked his head. Dave's fingers slipped, but he lunged back and bit down hard on the man's ear and held on. The man was screaming at him in rage. Dave could feel that rage, but he had plenty of his own. He pulled hard and felt the ear come away with a gush of hot blood. The man screamed and spun the wheel. The ambulance tilted, the left wheels came up off the ground, and the vehicle slowly turned over and crashed down on its right side. The sound of screeching metal was incredibly loud. Dave was riding the ambulance down as it fell, but he lost his grip on impact. His feet slammed into the face of the bearded man, and one of his shoes went right into his mouth. The vehicle slid to a stop on its side. The man was biting and coughing. The woman inside was screaming. Dave pulled his foot out of his shoe, leaving it in the bearded man's mouth. Blood was gushing everywhere from the man's ear. He yanked off the other shoe, scampered around to the back of the ambulance, and managed with some effort to get the doors open. The white coat man was lying on his side, bleeding from his mouth. Jamie was underneath the man, yelling. Dave dragged the white coat man out of the car, dropped him onto the street. Then he went and got Jamie, put him on his back, and ran, carrying him back to their house. Jamie said, "Are you hurt?" The ear was still in Dave's mouth. He spit it into his hand.
"No." "What's that in your hand?"
Dave opened his fist.
"It's an ear."
"Ugh! Ooh!"
"I bit his ear. He was bad. He hurted you. Ack!"
Up ahead, they saw everybody standing out on the front lawn of their house. Henry and Lynn and the new people, too. Dave put Jamie on the ground, and he ran to his parents. Dave waited for his mother, Lynn, to comfort him, but she was entirely focused on Jamie. It made him feel bad. He dropped the ear in his hand on the ground. Everybody was swirling around him, but nobody touched him. Nobody put their fingers in his fur. He felt more and more sad. Then he saw the boxy black car barreling down the street toward them. It was huge, high off the ground, and it drove right up onto the lawn. The Oxnard courtroom was small and so cold Bob Koch thought he would catch pneumonia. He was feeling none too good anyway. His hangover had left a very sour feeling in his stomach. The judge was a youngish guy, about 40, and he looked hungover too, but maybe not. Koch cleared his throat.
"Your Honor, I am here representing Alexandra Burnett, who is unable to be here in person."
"This court has ordered her to appear," the judge said, "in person."
"I am aware of that, Your Honor. But she and her child are presently being pursued by a bounty hunter who intends to remove tissue from their bodies, and she is therefore in flight to prevent that."
"What bounty hunter?" the judge said. "Why is there a bounty hunter involved in this?"
We would like to know exactly that, Your Honor, Bob Koch said. The judge turned. Mr. Rodriguez?
Your Honor, Rodriguez said, standing, there is no bounty hunter per se.
Well, what is there?
There is a professional fugitive recovery agent at work.
With what authorization?
He is not authorized per se. In this case, he is making a citizen's arrest, Your Honor.
Arrest of whom?
Of Ms. Burnett and her son.
On what basis?
Possession of stolen property, Your Honor.
To make a citizen's arrest, the possession of stolen property has to be witnessed by the person making the arrest.
Yes, Your Honor.
What has been witnessed?
The possession of the property in question, Your Honor.
You are talking about the Burnett cell line? The judge said.
Yes, Your Honor. As previously documented before this court, that cell line is owned by UCLA and licensed to Biogen in Westview. The ownership is attested to by several prior court rulings.
How, then, is it stolen?
Your Honor, we have evidence that Mr. Burnett conspired to eliminate the cell lines in possession of Biogen. But whether that is true or not, Biogen has the right to restore the cell lines that it owns.
It can restore them from Mr. Burnett.
Yes, Your Honor, presumably so, since the court has ruled that Mr. Burnett's cells belong to Biogen, they can at any time take more. Whether the property is actually within Mr. Burnett's body or not is immaterial. Biogen owns the cells.
You are denying Mr. Burnett's right to the integrity of his body?
The judge said, raising an eyebrow. With respect, Your Honor, there is no such right. Suppose someone took your wife's diamond ring and swallowed it. The ring is still your property.
Yes, the judge said, but I might be required to wait patiently for it to reappear.
Yes, Your Honor, but suppose for some reason the ring becomes stuck in the intestine. Don't you have the right to retrieve it?
Clearly, you do.
It can't be kept from you. It's your property wherever it is. Whoever swallows it assumes the risk of retrieval.
Koch thought he'd better move in. Your Honor, he said, if I remember my high school biology correctly, anything swallowed is not actually inside the body, any more than something inside a donut hole is inside the donut. The ring is outside the body.
Rodriguez began to sputter. Your Honor!
Your Honor, Koch said, raising his voice, I trust we can all agree that we are not talking about diamond rings that have been stolen. We're talking about cells that reside inside the human body. The notion that these cells can be owned by someone else, even if the appellate court has upheld a jury finding, leads to absurd conclusions, as you see here. If Biogen no longer possesses Mr. Burnett's cells, then they have lost them by their own foolish actions. They are not entitled to go back and get more. If you lose your diamond ring, you can't go back to the diamond mine and get a replacement.
Rodriguez said, The analogy is inexact.
Your Honor, all analogies are inexact.
In this instance, Rodriguez said, I would ask the court to stick narrowly to the issue at hand and consider the previous findings of the court that are relevant to the issue. The court has held that Biogen owns these cells. They came from Mr. Burnett, but they are the property of Biogen. We argue that we have the right to retrieve these cells at any time.
Your Honor, this argument directly conflicts with the 13th Amendment against chattel slavery. Biogen may own Mr. Burnett's cells, but they don't own Mr. Burnett. They can't.
We never claim to own Mr. Burnett, only his cells, and that is all we are asking for now, Rodriguez said.
But the practical consequence of your claim is that you effectively own Mr. Burnett, since you do claim access to his body at any time.
The judge was looking weary. Gentlemen, I see the issue, he said. But what does any of this have to do with Ms. Burnett and her son?
Bob Koch stepped back. Let Rodriguez bury himself on this one, he thought. The conclusion he was asking the court to draw was inconceivable.
Your Honor, Rodriguez said, if the court accepts that Mr. Burnett's cells are my client's property, as I believe it must, then said cells are my client's property wherever they are found. For example, if Mr. Burnett gave blood at a blood bank, the donated blood would contain cells that we own. We could assert ownership of those cells and demand to extract them from the donated blood, since Mr. Burnett is not legally able to give those cells to anyone else. They are our property. Similarly, the same cells that we own, the identical cells, are also found in Mr. Burnett's children and descendants. Therefore, we have ownership of those cells as well, and we have the right to take the cells.
And the bounty hunter?
The fugitive recovery specialist, Rodriguez said, is making a citizen's arrest on the following basis. If he sees Mr. Burnett's descendants, then since they are by definition walking around with our property, they are self-evidently in possession of stolen property and can be arrested.
The judge sighed.
Your Honor, Rodriguez said, this conclusion may strike the court as illogical, but the fact is that we are in a new era, and what seems strange to us now will in a few years not seem so strange. Already a large percentage of the human genome is owned. The genetic information for various disease organisms is owned. The notion that such biological elements are in private hands is only odd because it is new to us. But the court must rule in accordance with previous findings. The Burnett cells are our cells.
But in the case of descendants, the cells are copies, the judge said.
Yes, Your Honor, but that is not at issue. If I own a formula to make something, and someone Xeroxes that formula on a sheet of paper and gives it to another, it remains my property. I own the formula, no matter how it is copied or by whom. And I have the right to retrieve the copy.
The judge turned to Bob Koch.
Mr. Koch?
Your Honor, Mr. Rodriguez has asked you to rule narrowly.
So do I.
Previous courts held that once Mr. Burnett's cells were out of his body, they no longer belonged to him. They did not say that Mr. Burnett was a walking gold mine that could be plundered at will again and again by Biogen, and they certainly said nothing to imply that Biogen had a right to physically take these cells no matter who carried them. That claim goes far beyond any implication of the court's prior finding. It is, in fact, a new claim made out of nothing but wishful thinking. And we ask the court to require Biogen to call off this bounty hunter.
The judge said, I do not understand on what basis Biogen has simply acted on its own, Mr. Rodriguez. This appears hasty and unwarranted. You could certainly wait for Miss Burnett to appear before this court.
Unfortunately, Your Honor, that is not possible. The business situation of my client is critical. As I said to you, we believe we are victims of a conspiracy to deprive us of what is ours. Without going into details, it is urgent that the cells be replaced immediately. If the court forces a delay, we may lose an enormous business undertaking in the meanwhile, such that our company goes out of business. We merely attempt a timely response to an urgent problem.